filtered in by now. Thank you for joining us this morning to talk about a couple rating systems that are in our near future, and should have a very cool conversation about some things that are going beyond the building. My name is Brian Ott, and I'm a principal with TBG Partners here in Austin, and our firm is a planning and landscape architecture firm. So this part interests me a lot because as opposed to a lot of the initiatives over the past several years where we've been developing very sustainable buildings, I think it's now turning towards sustainable sites and how we treat the ecosystems around our sites, and I think that's going to be very exciting for us. Before we get started, how many of you are planners? Just show of hands. Developers? Any landscape architects? Very good. Well, cool. I'll go ahead and get started. Architects, I'm sorry. My bad. Civil engineers, others, and I'm sorry. Well, a couple things about presenters today. The first presenter is going to be Heather Venhouse. Heather is an environmental designer for the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center here in Austin, where she has spent the last decade working with teams of scientists, designers, and educational advisors on projects emphasizing sustainable design, landscape restoration, and environmental education. Heather is currently the project manager for Sustainable Sites Initiative and is also involved in private consulting projects throughout the center concerning ecological design, restoration, and outdoor education. Susan Mudd, who many of you probably have already heard speak and know very well. Susan is currently consulting with the State Environmental Leadership Program on a Midwest Global Warming Campaign Plan. Her work experience includes air and water quality, pesticides, waste, pollution prevention, transportation and land use, and women's health and the environment. She is currently serving on the board of the Center for Neighborhood Technology, Congress for the New Urbanism, and Earth Share of Illinois. So with that, I'll turn it over to Heather to get started.
Hello and welcome to Austin. I hope that you're able to get out and enjoy the beautiful weather while you're here. How many of you have heard of the Sustainable Sites Initiative? Good. Well, then I will start briefly with an introduction. The Sustainable Sites Initiative is an interdisciplinary partnership between 10 organizations, and what we're doing is developing national voluntary standards and guidelines for site sustainability. And when we say site sustainability, we are talking about the entire site, not just the building and the landscape. So we're not talking about a green building or a sustainable building with a sustainable landscape around it, but the integration of the two into a sustainable system where waste for one might be a resource for the other, and there's a synergy to create this balance. So a little background on the initiative. Our vision is quite broad, and it's one of the things that I love about this project. Basically, we want to change the paradigm in which we design, build, maintain, construct landscapes. And what we're talking about is linking the natural and built systems, improving the quality of life and the health of our communities. Participants, these organizations are involved in a group called the Product Development Committee. They help guide the development of the standards and guidelines we're currently creating. This is a consensus-based process that follows the USGBC LEED process because we anticipate our standards and guidelines being incorporated into LEED as well as other national and regional green rating systems. Our potential project types are quite broad. We are looking at sites both with and without buildings. Again, the sites with buildings creating that synergy between the landscape and the buildings to create a truly sustainable site. And then also landscapes that currently do not have green rating systems associated with them. So for those of you who are familiar with LEED, and I'm going to talk about LEED a lot because that is the system that I'm the most familiar with. However, I do recognize that there are other green rating systems out there that are also doing good work. But for those of you who are aware of LEED, you know that there are sustainable sites section. However, when you look at that sustainable sites section, you see that there are gaps in the performance, and those are the gaps that we are trying to fill. We see the work that we're creating enhancing existing green rating metrics, not competing against them, and so taking our information and filling the gaps and improving upon. Our current focus of research We did release our first preliminary report in November. Throughout this process, we began talking about developing standards and guidelines. We talked to several other green rating systems who had headed down this path for some advice, some lessons learned. And what they told us was it takes about 2 to 3 years to develop a rating system. So we went back to our stakeholder organizations, and we said, we need 2 to 3 years. They said, we don't have 2 to 3 years. We need it yesterday. What can you do to speed this up? And so what we agreed to do was to release a series of draft reports. And so when you look at the preliminary report, it is a draft of a draft. It's certainly not conclusive in any manner. It was simply a stopping point, a snapshot of where we were at this part of the process. November of this year, we will release our second report, which is a draft, which will have more meat, more benchmarks. We'll flesh out a little bit more of the information, and then we will get to the final standards and guidelines in summer of 2009. We are working with around 40 national experts around the country, and this is really the crux of the folks, the crux of the project, actually. These people provide us the technical expertise that we need. These people volunteer their time, their energy. We could not advance without them. So our guiding principles, like all projects, we stepped back in the beginning and we said, okay, before we get into the nitty-gritty and before we start working with all these technical subcommittees about defining a sustainable site, let's start by laying out some guiding principles. Some guiding principles that we can use as a litmus test along the way to make sure that we're staying on the right track. And if you go to the preliminary report, which is at sustainablesites.org, all of the information in this project is free. It's one of the things I love about it. It will always be free, available to the public. Download it, go and do good things. If you go to the website, you can find more detail about these guiding principles. So I'm not going to go into them in detail, but I am going to talk about a couple of my favorites. One of those being the precautionary principle. And I'm sure you're aware of the precautionary principle, basically stating that if we don't know, move forward with caution. And we are striving to only use peer-reviewed research, sound science, in many of the standards and guidelines that we're developing. However, there are some areas where that sound science does not exist. And so we are recommending that we move forward with the precautionary principle. Some of this has to do with chemicals, toxins, herbicides, pesticides. You can do a ton of research and get conflicting information either way. But the truth is we don't know. And so we recommend moving forward, using the precautionary principle and being careful. And I think my most favorite is the regenerative systems as an intergenerational equity. And we have Fritz Steiner on our team. Fritz is over here in the corner. And Fritz has a lovely way of coming up with these beautiful phrases and words. And I think that this is one of Fritz's. And what I love about it is regenerative systems. Sites have, landscapes have, the ability to go beyond sustainable, to contribute back to our natural capital, to pay back our environmental debt, and to build back the capital for future generations. And I'm sure many of you are aware of the book Natural Capital. Amory Lovins talking about how we've gone beyond spending our interest. We're now spending our natural capital, and we're creating a mess for future generations. With landscapes, with sustainable sites, you can pay back that natural capital. We can build up that interest, and we can provide the quality of life for future generations. So I find that very exciting. I think we're all familiar with the success of green building. And I point this out to you because this is why we are so excited about the work that's being done with the Sustainable Sites Initiative and why we truly believe that it can have an impact and that we can change the way we can change this paradigm. And one of the things to note, though, about the success of green building is that when you look at other programs around the world, and this is a chart that was developed by the City of Seattle. It's looking at the Berlin Biotope Area Factor, which Seattle adopted into the Seattle Green Factor, which is basically a way for measuring site sustainability, landscape sustainability. And so the red line that you see going across the presentation, I mean across the slide here, is that's the lowest mark that you need to receive for this landscape metric in Seattle and in Berlin. And the gray bars that you see are silver certified LEED buildings in the city of Seattle. So what they did was they took these LEED buildings and they ran them through this other metric to see how the site was performing. And you see that only two of the buildings actually met the site, sustainable site performance. And what that tells us is that there's a purpose for what we're doing. There's a room for improvement, that we can create a product that is useful to the existing green rating systems and not in competition with them. So linking sites and landscapes to sustainability. You know, many of these figures, you can look at them as your glass is half empty or your glass is half full. My glass is half full. I'm very young. I have a long time to live. We have a family. My glass is half full. We can do something about this. We can make these changes. And so you can take a statistic, like 30 to 65% of the water is used daily on landscapes, and you can say, okay, landscapes have a huge opportunity to help us deal with the water crisis that our nation is currently having and that is headed towards not only our nation, but countries around the world. We know that combined sewer overflow systems, these are systems where stormwater as well as rainwater is combined into one sewer system, and so when there's a lot of storm surge, raw sewage ends up in our riparian corridors, which is a health issue as well as a habitat issue. By keeping more of your stormwater on your site, and I'm not talking about huge ponds or huge detention basins, I'm actually talking about integrating that into the site and reusing it on the site, we can reduce the impact that stormwater has on these combined sewer overflow systems, reducing the need for municipal infrastructure as well as development infrastructure. We talked about the precautionary principle and the millions of households using pesticides. Again, you can wear yourself out going back and forth. There's been a tremendous amount of doubt developed around chemicals and what they do to us. The truth is we don't know. We should be careful. And then the Soil Subcommittee, which is a subcommittee that I've truly enjoyed working with because I think it's one of the ones that I've learned the most from. And one of the things that they've helped me to understand is that soils are living ecosystems in themselves, and that there are millions of biota in those ecosystems that have a symbiotic relationship with the vegetation, with the health of the vegetation and the infiltration of the water. Standard construction practices such as compaction, such as disturbance, basically influence the health, often eliminating the soil biota. And so what can we do in our site design to protect that soil biota so that it can continue to provide us with those ecosystem services? In Texas alone, we spend around $150 million a year dealing with landfill yard waste. And this is waste that should be a resource. Vegetative material is needed on a site not only to help with organic matter. Organic matter in the soil has a tremendous ability to hold water, as well as its habitat for the soil biota that we just spoke about. Taking this resource and putting it in the landfill as a waste not only creates greenhouse gases, methane, which is 24 times stronger than carbon dioxide, but also it's a waste of money. It's a resource. It's not a waste. And so when you think about Texas, and I don't know how many of you are Texans in this room, but I can think of lots of other programs I'd rather be spending that $150 million on than landfills. Moving on to heating and cooling. I think before our technology, heating and air conditioning came around, we knew this. We knew that by placing vegetation in the right place, you can reduce the energy costs. You can create a space that is more comfortable for a building. Now there are programs out there like U4 and Stratum that are measuring the ability of trees to reduce the energy consumption in buildings, and we know that we can do this by about 25%. It's a huge energy savings as we move forward with our world issues and global warming. And in New York alone, which took this Stratum tool, looked at their urban forest, put in the data that they needed to understand the ecosystem services of that urban forest, found out that the trees in New York result in $27.8 million in savings a year. This is not only energy savings, but this is water storm surge savings because of infiltration. Vegetation catches water by its leaves, holds it in the air. It either releases it slowly to the ground so that it can sink into the soil, or it's evaporated through evapotranspiration back into the air, thus creating a livable climate. What this all boils down to is the idea of ecosystem services. And how many of you are aware of the term ecosystem services and the science behind it? A few of you, good. Basically, ecosystem services are the natural systems that support our lives on this earth. These systems have been estimated, and this is a conservative estimation, to be valued at $16 to $54 trillion per year, and this is twice our global GNP. And so what we're saying here is that nature has provided systems that allows us to survive on this planet. We can create widgets to replace these systems and put the Earth on somewhat of a respirator or life support system. But if we do that, we're going to have to spend the global GNP to accomplish it. So it's much easier to work within the natural system and to keep these services to maintain our quality of life. This is an illustration from the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with the assessment, but I strongly recommend reading it. It's an evaluation of ecosystem services on the global, on the planet, and looking at the cultures, the regions of the planet that are basically diminishing or going away because of the lack of these ecosystem services. And what I love about this diagram is that it's showing that ecosystem services occur at every landscape level. They are not limited to green fields. They are not limited to pristine ecosystems. They can and they should perform at every landscape, including urban, densely urban landscapes. So the goal is that the left looks like the right, or actually not looks, but functions like the right. And so that are cities, that are developments, function like a healthy ecosystem. And again, I'm using the term function because it's not about aesthetics. It's not about restoration of putting these ecosystems back in place. That's good in many circumstances, but it's not applicable to all. But it's about understanding the function of these ecosystems and mimicking that function or providing that function on your site. So what do these ecosystems offer us? And just one other point before we move on to those ecosystems. Talk about a huge contribution that we are getting ready to make. You know, there's a lot of urban infill, gray fill, that is coming back around for redevelopment. We can go back around, redevelop that with ecosystem services in mind. Think of the contribution that we could make to repairing some of our urban ecosystems. So what are the ecosystem services that are provided? Livable atmosphere without vegetation, without healthy soils, without the geochemical processes that those two support, we could not live on this planet. The temperatures would be too hot. The climate regulation, the heating and cooling, the greenhouse gases, all of this is provided by the natural systems. Detoxifying and cleansing air and water. This, again, is a symbiotic relationship between the vegetation and the plants. The particulate matter that can be collected by leaves, absorbed, circulated, and then released back to us into what we need every day, oxygen. And then with water, the ability of vegetation, soils to absorb and clean water, to slow it down and allow it to slowly move into our riparian corridors. Providing habitat. Here we're not only talking about habitat for all organisms, but our habitat, human habitat. We're working with the Human Well-Being Subcommittee to understand the health, both cognitive and physical, benefits of outdoor spaces to humans, and that we actually function at a much higher level when these spaces are built with us in mind. And the idea that we have an innate connection to the landscape, without this connection, we simply don't do as well. We're simply not as happy. We simply do not perform at the level we could. Sequestering carbon, both above ground in the biomass as well in the soil, and I will go into this in more detail. We talked about the physical, mental health, and of course there are many others. But I challenge you, as you travel around the world, wherever you're from, and you begin to look at sites, you begin to look at landscapes, that you go beyond looking at that landscape for its aesthetic value, but you begin to think about all the other ecosystem services that that landscape is providing. And many of these ecosystem services in some places can be at odds with each other. And it is not uncommon for humans to love a site to death. You know, some of these beautiful places, humans visit them regularly without thought of how we maintain these ecosystem services and diminish them. So the question then becomes, how can we build and maintain these systems so that the maintenance practices can stay in place that keep these natural functions? So we're going to talk about one ecosystem service in detail, which is carbon. We're talking about carbon because it's a hot topic right now, Gore and others, but we do certainly acknowledge that there are other greenhouse gases that need to be discussed. So on our planet, there are a couple carbon pools. These are natural carbon pools. The numbers that you see are in petagrams, which is 10 to the 15th, and we're working in metric tons here. So it's a really, really big number. But the atmosphere is a pool of about 750, fossil fuels around 5,000. Fossil fuels are just living organic matter, carbon that's been put in the ground, held in there for a long time, now we're pumping it out for energy. Oceans, a huge, huge pool. Soil, see, soil is actually greater than the atmosphere. And then vegetation. Now what we're going to look at here is the amount of carbon being moved from these systems. Of course, the fossil fuels going into the atmosphere, this has to do with energy, using fossil fuels to move us around, to keep us warm, to keep us cool. Geochemical processes moves carbon from the ocean into the atmosphere, and then back from the atmosphere into the ocean. You notice that's an increase. Of course, plants take in carbon. This is part of photosynthesis. And then turn it around for a byproduct that keeps us alive. And then plants also release carbon back into the atmosphere. And you'll notice that they're not releasing as much as they're taking in, and that has to do with the rest of it going in the soil. Plants move carbon into the soil through their carbohydrates, through their tissues. They have the ability to place this carbon in the soil very deep in places that it can stay for tens of hundreds of years. The carbon is removed by disturbance, whether it be agricultural disturbance or any disturbance that speeds up the decomposition of this organic matter and then starts the natural process over again, releasing that carbon back into the air. And so what you see is that there's more carbon going into the atmosphere than the soils have the ability to hold. What this tells us is we need to be thinking about our soils, about our site management, about how we can encourage the sequestration of carbon into our soils. And I'm not saying that any of these issues are, you know, a silver bullet to where we're headed down this carbon road. But I think many in this room would agree that we're going to have to take multiple tactics to achieve common goals. And so what we see here is that our fossil fuels are losing carbon, our atmosphere is gaining carbon, our oceans, our plants are zeroing out, and our soils are at a deficit. So you start looking, what are the differences we can make? What is it that we can do? Well, the two big ones are how we manage our soils and how we use our fossil fuels. So there are a couple ideas floating around right now about carbon sequestration and locking carbon up in the ocean, sinking it down, pumping it into the ground in wells. And these things are being explored. But what I would like to encourage is that we do have a natural process, a photosynthesis, that has worked for hundreds of thousands of years that we know is very effective with storing carbon and with creating the atmosphere and the ecosystem services that we need to provide. So how is it that we can use our sites to increase this function, to increase the productivity of our landscapes? And very quickly, I'm going to show you a chart here that's dealing with above and below ground carbon. And so the green that you see is the above ground carbon in these ecosystems, and the brown is the below ground. And so you see ecosystems like peatlands and wetlands have a tremendous amount of carbon stored in them. That has to do with the soils being anaerobic. They're not breaking down. The organic matter is staying put. And so until those ecosystems are disturbed or dried, that carbon can stay locked up for a long time. But in addition to those very specialized ecosystems, notice that grassland systems and forest systems aren't doing so bad. They actually have something to contribute. This has to do with long-lived vegetation, but also very deep root systems. And then very quickly, as we talk about biodiversity and the importance of biodiversity, studies do show that landscapes that are more diverse have the ability to store more carbon. So working with Methuen and the Wildflower Center began to develop a beta test for a program called Build Carbon Neutral. It's a website you can go to for free. You put in your building numbers, you put in your site numbers, some things, some characteristics about your site, and it begins to tell you what is your true carbon footprint. We're not talking about just the carbon footprint of your building, but we're talking about the carbon footprint of your site. And what's beautiful about this is that through the 2030 challenge, the AIA, the Council of Mayors, and many others who are striving towards carbon neutral buildings, carbon neutral cities, they've basically created a market in which they cannot accomplish this without looking at their entire site. They're going to have to use their site and use some of these natural processes that we spoke about as a carbon sink. So this is an example of that. If you look at this building, we ran it through the calculator. These are the numbers that we got. That the development of this building was about 240 metric tons of CO2. We added some grassland. You notice these numbers going down, some shrubs, then some trees. And now we get to a wetland where suddenly this site is a carbon sink. And so if and when we move into carbon trading, into mitigation, the site suddenly has something that it can offer in addition to resources. And then you put a green roof on that, and suddenly you do have a carbon neutral building. You have achieved your goal, plus you have these 15 metric tons to play with. So the question, how can the site protect or enhance ecosystem services? That's really what we're striving towards. And we're looking at this hierarchy of change. With our water, first we should conserve, reuse, and balance, and then regenerate these systems. Give back energy, of course, reduce, renew, offset, and then produce habitat, preserve, protect, restore, and then, of course, regenerate, again, giving back. And then materials, it's good to know that the three R's that have been around for a long time will actually do the trick. And so we can continue to move down the road of reduce, reuse, and recycle, and I think meet our needs. So a couple of strategies to do this. And in the first preliminary report, there were over 200 strategies. And the important thing to note about these strategies is that they're not applicable to every site. In order to have a sustainable site, you need an integrated design team that has folks, professionals on it from the beginning that understand the site and they understand the sustainable goals that you're trying to achieve, and they work with you to get there, again, integrating the building and the landscape. And so we had many people come to us and say, this strategy won't work on our site. We agree with that. And we challenge the design teams to understand your site to find the appropriate strategy. But these are examples of some strategies that have worked for others. And so what we're talking about, of course, is restoring impacted wetlands, streams, and habitat features. This should be the first thing that we do. It's pretty simple. And I think it's something that's been around for a while that we need to continue to encourage. Of course, harvesting our rainwater, and we support harvesting rainwater even in areas that have a tremendous amount of rain. And this has to do with relieving some of that pressure that's put on the storm sewer, and then possibly reusing that water maybe back in the building to flush toilets or on the landscape at a later time. And then using low-impact development processes, directing runoff from impervious surfaces into vegetated areas so that this water can be cooled, so that it can be cleaned, so that it can provide habitat, and so that it can move back into the system very slowly. Soil strategies, in the same way that we develop vegetation protection plans, developing soil protection plans, actually testing the health of your soil before you begin construction and setting aside the healthy soil areas, making sure that they stay impacted, because it is easier to protect something that's good in the first place rather than to go backward and try to restore it. Limiting soil disturbance, we talked about that, not only for soil biota but also soil carbon. And then moving towards an integrated pest management for site maintenance. And we're talking about integrated pest management because this is the low toxicity option. Moving through a series of steps, through low impact development, you continue to get more integrated into chemicals as you move forward, but you try other options first. And the reason this is important is because chemicals used to maintain landscapes kill soil biota. It's pretty simple. They have a negative impact on the soil biota. And so not only on ourselves, but on that soil biota, again, using the precautionary principle, being careful about that. Vegetation, there are tools to understand what vegetation can be used to filter pollutants and sequester carbon, other greenhouse gases. All vegetation does this to some extent. Some is better than others. An example is pines. Pines are very good at catching particulate matter. This has to do with the surface area, the volume. If you think about it, all the pine needles, that's a continuous screen. When air filters through it, there's more volume, more space for particulates to catch on those leaves and be captured by that vegetation. Also using vegetation, of course, that relates to the needs of the site. And often this may mean the site as you find it or the site that it's going to be constructed. And then looking at native or regionally appropriate adapted vegetation. You notice we are saying native or regionally appropriate. We do acknowledge that there are great plant species out there that are not native. However, we need to take precaution that these species are not invasive so that they do not have a negative effect on the surrounding ecosystems. And this is something that is solely on the onus of the project team. The U.S. does not blacklist vegetation. And so we have to educate ourselves to do this. The reason this is important is because there are the top two factors in biodiversity reduction on this planet. First is habitat destruction, the second is invasive species. The largest conduit for invasive species in this country is the horticulture industry, bringing in plants because they're beautiful, because they do things that for their aesthetics that we can appreciate. However, without understanding how that plant will affect surrounding ecosystems, we can actually cause much broader damage. Materials, again, the reuse, the recycle, the renew, the local materials, looking at the embodied energy, local materials for vegetation can come much closer than some of the lead guidelines that you're seeing of 500 miles. For vegetation and soils, we're hoping that you can get it around to 100, 200. And then, of course, human well-being, creating human habitat, sites that make people feel safe and comfortable and want to spend time outside. So moving on to the schedule for the initiative and what you can expect from us. We will be in a partnership and collaboration phase throughout the project. And this is looking at the first 5 years of the project. Beyond that, there may be more. You know, we'll see. We'll get through the first 5 years first. But right now, we are in the process of writing the standards and guidelines, which are a series of three reports, as I stated to you, with basically the drafts approving upon the content of the previous draft, with the finals coming out in 2009. From there, we'll move into weighing and crediting and distinguishing on a bioregional factor which credit should be worth more in one region versus another, looking at these ecosystem services and helping regions understand what they have to offer. There will be a pilot project phase, testing around 100 projects across the U.S. This is to test the standards and guidelines and the way we've weighed them, very similar to other pilot programs. We will not begin actually looking at the pilot projects until 2009. So those of you who have pilot projects that are interested in them, we will be sending out applications for those on our websites and in other places. But currently, we do have case studies running that we're taking until May 1st. For these case studies, we are asking for suggestions or examples of sustainable practices that you're currently using on your sites, whether it be anything from an integrated design team all the way to a stormwater management or some sort of a soil protection plan, anything to do with site design. We will take this information and incorporate it into future educational materials for sustainable sites. And then, of course, we'll move into a reference guide. And throughout this time, we see ourselves partnering with the USGBC and other green rating systems to improve their standards and guidelines. And so if you'd like more information about sustainable sites, you can get it here. I'll also be around to answer questions afterwards, and I would also encourage you to talk to Fritz Steiner over here. So thank you.
Good morning. One detail, for those of you who are wondering about your AIA credits, the sign-up is in a table near the back. Okay. While Brian's helping me on the technology front, I'm Susan Mudd, and I have the opportunity today to speak with you about LEED for Neighborhood Development and the potential relationship between the Sustainable Sites Initiative that ASLA and the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center have taken on with others. One question, can we see a show of hands for how many people are LEED ND pilots? Got a few, great. And is there some relative comfort or understanding of LEED ND among most? Can I see a show of hands? Okay. In terms of knowledge about it, sorry, I don't mean comfort with all of the details, of course. Because we're here to hear feedback, as you know. So we're not getting it up. Okay, thank you, Brian. Okay. I wanted to start by just running through some different images dealing with what New Urbanists and others, what New Urbanists refer to as the transect, but Heather referred to as landscapes, and different understandings of them in a visual way. Which button do I push? Down, thank you. So this is a natural biota from sea to hilltop. Transect, which New Urbanists would be more familiar with, mostly at the community scale, from urban center out to rural edge. A Midwestern version, I've been told. And many of you would have seen this from Andreas the other day. The first version, a long time ago, I can't remember the date, I apologize, showing human interaction at the scale of against the transect, dealing with exploitation of or use of natural materials, and a transect that New Urbanists are familiar with in terms of the zones T1 to T6. I bring this up as background because it's something that those of us dealing with LEED for Neighborhood Development have been struggling with, and which seems particularly appropriate when we talk about sustainable sites and integration of landscape elements. Within the process of LEED for Neighborhood Development, which, as many of you know, is a partnership effort of the NRDC, the U.S. Green Building Council, and the Congress for New Urbanism, which has been trying to bring together the principles and practices, the best, from the smart growth community, from New Urbanists, and from green building. One of the things we've struggled with throughout this process is how to bring the transect and the fine-grained information that it carries into a national voluntary rating system. I'm just going to give you a tiny bit of background on LEED for ND for the few people in the room who don't have the background. LEED for Neighborhood Development, like other LEED systems, is built on prerequisites, which are thresholds that a project or a building must contain, or things that must happen in order to qualify into the system at all. And then credits are things for which one gets points to layer on and to, as it turns out, they're all medals that one gets, silver, gold, and platinum, according to how many points one piles on in one's project. But within LEED for ND, for neighborhood development, excuse me, there are three sets of things that are looked at. The first we call smart location and linkage. That's where is the project? Where is the site? And this is something critical to our discussion today. The second is neighborhood pattern. The first is if you looked at the constituencies making up this joint effort, the smart growth constituency especially were focused on smart location and linkage. The neighborhood pattern and design is the strength and expertise particularly brought by new urbanists. What is built on the site? How is it laid out? What's the street density, et cetera? And the third, green construction and technology, is clearly the expertise that's been brought in by the green building folks. There is overlap, but just to give you a sense that this is the way the system, as it's currently in pilot version, is constructed. This is where the 230-some pilot projects, which are now going on, are scattered around the country, just to give you a sense. We definitely have regional diversity, although not every state is represented, and many, such as California, are heavily represented. We've now got the first three certified projects, which have just been certified within the last week in the pilot project, and more are coming in, we're happy to see. Just to give you a sense of the time frame, which Heather did for the Sustainable Sites Initiative, the work, Heather mentioned that she had been told that it took 2 to 3 years to build a rating system with LEED. I can tell you it's taken us a little longer already, and we're still not done. The pilot program finally launched late last year, and we are, as I told you, getting certifications in now, and we'll have them in by next January, but are already starting within the next month the revisions. And this is a plug for any of you who have looked at the rating system or get the opportunity to look at it vis-a-vis any of your projects. There will be more official comment periods, but feel free to send in comments even outside of the official time frame. We need your input as we revise the system. And we hope by late 09 to be complete with what will be the first version that would be official. It would be out for public use. The website I give you here, it's important for you to have this to be able to join the corresponding committee for those of you who already aren't, and we appreciate the hundreds of you who have already joined the corresponding committee, but this is your easy way to get on. The corresponding committee will send you minutes of our meetings, which I can tell you are relatively useless, but the important thing is you'll get the announcements about when the public comment periods are, and you know the big announcements you'll get first this way. So please join the corresponding committee, even if you choose not to read the minutes. Okay, I showed the transect early on, just to mention that we've tried to incorporate the transect in a couple of ways, and again, I think it's important in terms of the landscape discussion, which is why I mention it again here. We tried to put it in, and we used crude surrogates, frankly, because we, given the constituencies that were working on LEED-ND, we did not have a common parlance, a common language of the transect to be able to build it completely into the system. So we used surrounding street grid density, and the precise measurement used was center lines per square mile, and surrounding built density, dwelling units per acre, or FAR, in some of the prerequisites and credits, but it is not built into the entire system. But this shows you, these numbers are too small, but anyway, shows you some of the ways we tried to do it. Okay, now this is text that looks really boring, but I wanted to show you some of the places in LEED-ND, and I've got a few slides like this, where we believe that the Sustainable Sites Initiative could specifically inform our work. The LEED for ND, as I mentioned early on, really focused on location as a key component, and it's a threshold or a prerequisite across which one must enter to get into the system. So the view that we have of site sustainability in LEED-ND is largely about location, avoiding sensitive areas and being in a place that's either in an existing place that's already habited, or adjacent or connected through a transportation infrastructure or other existing infrastructure. One of the goals of LEED-ND, frankly, and it's controversial within the CNU, is to try to give priority and recognition of development which is in infill, which is on brownfield locations, or which is connected to existing transit systems, with the idea that if we build up the places where there's a lot of space but not where it's not fully developed, we can, in that way, recognize the sustainability of having people in very pleasant, denser communities, and in that way avoid more spreading out across the landscape and destroying more more precious lands by having more sprawl. And there is that predilection and a bias, if you will, within LEED-ND, and it's pretty conscious. But the ways, places that we see we could have some real positive influence on the work of LEED-ND from Sustainable Sites Initiative, I've made some lists here. In the location and linkage arena, proximity to water and wastewater infrastructure, imperiled species and ecological communities, wetland and water body conservation, farmland conservation, and floodplain avoidance. So for instance, in the imperiled species, one of the things that's called for in LEED-ND to meet that prerequisite has to do with habitat conservation plans and mapping and management plans, many of which there is more in-depth knowledge of and being developed by the people working on the Sustainable Sites Initiative. So that would be an example. In farmland conservation, one of the things that we seek in LEED-ND to avoid is having construction on prime soils, unique soils, and soils of state significance. And clearly many of the people working in the Sustainable Sites Initiative have incredible depth of knowledge on soils, and we'd hope to learn, be informed by that. So those are a couple of examples there. Further in the smart location and linkage sections, steep slope protection, site design for habitat or wetland conservation, that's clearly an area where the Sustainable Sites Initiative would have informative things to add to our work, restoration of habitat or wetland and conservation management of habitat or wetlands. Moving into the neighborhood pattern and design section, the walkable streets, access to public spaces, and local food production seem to me to be arenas in which the Sustainable Sites Initiative could help us. For instance, in walkable streets, there's a couple of places where there's a call for street trees and other vegetation, and this is an area where there's particular sensitivity and concern within the CNU that I would want the folks with Sustainable Sites Initiative to be alert to, and I know, Heather, that you're sensitive to this because you mentioned that not every site would have the same response. There's definitely concern within new urbanist community about LEED-ND that we're going to require, you know, a certain number of trees on every block and that it will interfere with the human experience along the street. So those are the sorts of places where I see useful interaction and work. Within the green construction and technology, the third section of LEED-ND, I see that there's places in terms of water use, site disturbance, both through site design, which Heather mentioned, and during construction, where there could definitely be positive interaction, and also on stormwater management, heat island reduction, wastewater management, and comprehensive waste management. Now, I wanted to show, and this is only a partial slide. I couldn't, even with my teenage, technologically oriented son, could not get the whole thing up so you could see it. Some work of one of the new urbanists that's just out that some of you may have seen in the hall, but I wanted to bring to your attention because it seems to me something that could inform both LEED-ND and the Sustainable Sites Initiative. This is new work called the Light Imprint Handbook. And for those of you who haven't yet been cornered or cornered yourself, the folks out there doing this work, from DPZ, I want to call this to your attention. They are looking for people to review this work because this is the first version out of it. And what it is, which you can see the top of, well, you probably can't read it, I apologize, is they've tried to take the transect and look at paving, channeling, storage, and filtration, and shown some of the different solutions and how they vary across the transect. And this hopefully will help inform all of us as we think about what are the solutions that fit in which places the best. So any of you who have the time and ability to look at any part of it, I know they're looking for good input, and we think this could help all of our work. Yeah, go for it, Heather. And here's some examples which we would like to get into the Sustainable Sites Initiative for interactive work. And this is an example. Compost bins and how they... Can you all see these pictures? Maybe I should pick one that has color. Like green roofs, the middle of these three slides. This is showing how green roofs might be done in the more urban, the T4 to T6 zones. That's the middle set of slides. And, okay. Then solar roofs are the top one of this, showing again. This is showing on the more rural end of the transect, how rural... Excuse me, how solar roofs could be done in, for instance, edge yards or side yards. And sorry, this is back to green roofs or the middle section here. This is on the more rural end of the transect. And here we see, and many of you will recognize this from the smart code, so these are some tools that have been developed by New Urbanists that we hope the sustainable sites people can give us feedback on and potentially integrate. How public plantings fit across the transect. So we all agree that we want this greenness in the landscape integrated, but we want to do it in a way that's also sensitive to the urbanity, as Heather mentioned. We're going to move on. How are we doing on time? Doing okay. Here's an example, again, this one from the smart code, I believe, about food production across the transect. From farm on the top, agricultural plots, vegetable gardens, urban farm, community gardens, green roofs, and vertical farms. And I mention this because we've tried to, without even having this benefit of this transect look, we've tried to integrate some of these elements into LEED-ND, but it, frankly, LEED-ND does not have this degree of sensitivity in it yet to the transect. And I don't know in terms of where the Sustainable Sites Initiative is yet along this, but we hope it can. These things can inform us both. Oh, that one, forget. Okay, and I think I'm going to stop now so we have time for questions. I think I'll make a couple comments and then turn it over for questions. You want to turn this off, Brian? One of the things I just wanted to give a little more comment about how I see the interaction or the potential interaction of LEED for neighborhood development and sustainable sites. As I mentioned, those of us who've been working on LEED for neighborhood development really focused a lot on site location. And one of the reasons is something which I saw that I wanted to mention in Heather's presentation about sustainable sites. We are aware and informed by your work about the possibilities for improving sites, you know, once a site has been selected. And the visual that you showed about the Wildflower Center and how it could be contributing less carbon was great in terms of some of the solutions that you've come up with. One of the things we've been thinking a lot about in LEED for Neighborhood Development is another element that, as yet, I didn't see reflected in your work, and it's just, it may change over time, but that is the transportation element, which is something that's a strong, which for which there's a strong element which within the CNU. We know that in many places, many cities, many regional areas, the transportation energy and the energy embodied in getting to and from a building is as much as, and in some cases, more than the amount that's currently involved in the building. So we've been trying to look at the scale of reducing that as well. And so one of the things that I hope we can both be thinking about in this process is how to not be pushing things to sites that result in further transportation energy, and trying to think how we can improve urban sites while recognizing that if we have high density, we're providing this other function too of not pushing further transportation energy. So it's something where I can see work that we need to be thinking about on both sides. And I guess I'll stop there and we can see where the questions and comments and feedback lead us.
We've got a few minutes left for questions. If anybody has any, would like to shout them out, I'll repeat them so that everybody else can hear as well.
Okay. Susan, you mentioned that there were several lead ending pilots that have now been approved. Is there the availability to review those somewhere on the national side, or is there somebody we need to talk to? I'd love to be able to see those.
Okay. Could everybody hear the question? Do you want? Okay.
The question was lead Indy pilots that are being approved right now, is there a place that everybody else can go review those?
There are only three that have been certified, and literally it happened within this week, and we haven't even put it out publicly yet. So literally we're working on the press releases now, the joint organizational. Excuse me?
Everybody has to raise their right hand and you're not
to
tell.
Oh, I can tell you where they are.
Okay.
They're actually Elliott Tower, which I believe is in Portland. Helensville, which is in the Portland area, and the other one I'm going to totally blank on, but it's not in Portland. It's in California. It's in San Mateo, and I'm embarrassed that I'm blanking on the name. You'd think I could remember three names, wouldn't you? And what I can tell you is that they range in their ratings from silver to gold. The Elliott Tower is unusual in our preconception, or our conception going through Lead for Neighborhood Development, is that we were going to see projects in the scale of two buildings to a new town. Elliott Tower broke our expectations by being a single building, but it fits within our concept that it helps to fill out, round out a neighborhood. And so, anyway, but none of these three, and I have not seen all the information because literally I just saw this as we were coming to this Congress. My understanding from the two pictures that I've seen of each is that none of these would be stellar in the sense of the landscaping elements. But, you know, maybe I'll, but there's 200 more projects or 230 more projects to go, so we'll see what else comes in. Oh, sorry. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Station Park Green, San Mateo, right? Thank you for helping my brain.
I'm Mary Vogel from Plan Green, and I just wanted to say how absolutely thrilled I was to see sustainable sites come out in November. I have been waiting for it for 3 years ever since they first heard about it when I was living in Washington, D.C. And, you know, when it finally came out, I rushed over to Portland Metro and, you know, they actually had a confab about sustainable sites and inviting people from throughout the region to comment together and all. And I submitted separate comments too. But I think it has the potential to transform landscape architecture the way Mead has transformed architecture.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, and this is so desperately needed. Every little piece of ground, every little part of the landscape in your project can perform ecosystem services. No matter T6 to T1, you know, you really need to pay attention to sustainable sites. I just think this is transformational, and I am so thrilled about it that, you know, that it's finally come out, and boy, I'm going to work hard to help integrate it into CNU. And, you know, and again, to Tom's light imprint new urbanism, because frankly, they have a long way to go. They show English ivy on trees in the Pacific Northwest, and we're in some harmony.
But that's why I mentioned that they're seeking comment right now, just like the Sustainable Sites Initiative. It's a great opportunity to have the integration. And there's Tom. Can you call on Tom?
Yeah, we have a long way to go. Top 5 and the freeway. You did this.
That's his book.
This nice little handbook that we have limited copies of. There's a very nice article in the Green Community
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, I want to say that I'm very impressed with the Sustainable Sites Initiative, and I look forward to hearing more about the in-depth rating system. And I think it's vital and necessary that we study this in more detail than what's currently available with the leading D rating system. But my question is, and more just based on your opinion on it, is do you think there's any issue with either the rating system losing credibility with there being two out there rather than there's several rating systems for different types of projects? Do you think there's a fit more collaboration with Lead ND, or is it more site specific and more geared towards individual micro scale projects?
I think that the Sustainable Sites Initiative is evolving to meet the needs of our culture. And that I was at the Gulf Coast Green Conference yesterday. Our magaziner from the Clinton Initiative spoke, and he was looking at the numbers for global warming. He said we have 6,442 days. I don't think we have time to argue about what rating system goes where it goes. We want anyone to take the information, whether they're going to get rated or not, and use it and make it so that the quality of our lives on this planet can be maintained or improved.
Can I just answer a little bit to that, too?
Oh.
I absolutely agree with Heather in terms of wanting these things to be as useful as they can. My only concern is that we not lead to further confusion. And the reason that I'm concerned about confusion is so people think they're doing one thing or think they're getting rated. I just don't want there to be more confusion. But I absolutely agree that people should grab whatever is useful and, you know, take it and run with it. So we share that, and the CNU entered into the LEED partnership because we saw the excitement that LEED has generated in among builders nationwide and in some places and worldwide, and we wanted to help ensure that the best of new urbanism could be brought together with green buildings, and so we're excited about the fact of getting more input and expertise from the landscape architects as well.
Got a question way in the back.
Could everybody hear the questions? Okay. Without seeing a site map, I could only guess as to whether or not it qualifies. 40 miles sounds like a long way, but I know distances in Atlanta are bigger than some others, and maybe you're near a metro, or maybe you're not. In terms of and the site location is critical in LEED for neighborhood development. I would urge you, whether or not, or if you think there's an issue about your location being the sole reason that you could or couldn't get into LEED for neighborhood development, I would urge you to please write in to the as a corresponding committee member and tell us, because one of the things as we revise the system, we've got a problem in that we don't know about the developments that didn't apply. We only know about the ones that did apply. And if there are ones that should that we think should have been in the system or should be capable of being in the system, but aren't because of a prerequisite, we need to know. So please let us know. On your question about, what was this other question? Oh, thank you. LEED buildings. Yes. Okay. There is not a prerequisite about having green buildings or LEED certified buildings. There are points available if you do. In the pilot version. Could people hear that? That was a nice analogy. Could people hear Fritz's analogy?
His words are beautiful. I don't know if they could hear it. So Fritz was just saying that we've been thinking about sustainable sites as LEED and D dealing with the bones, and sustainable sites is the meat around those bones.
Question over here.
I'm just begging you to send in comments. We've sought formal ways, and frankly, the system has discouraged it. But we would urge you, in no uncertain terms, to please let us know by sending something in to the corresponding committee. So there's not a formal process at this moment, but we're collecting information. So the question, in case some of you couldn't hear it, deals with local food production and understanding, and his example was that his CSA in Portland has had to go further out because of pressures, has had to go even further out to grow the food that would then be brought into the city, either in a CSA in this case, but it also could be farm markets. Is that accurate? Okay. Within the conversations around LEED for neighborhood development, we struggled over wanting to encourage access to and local food production. There is a credit in the current pilot version, and it's done so that there's a credit available for neighborhood farms and gardens or community-supported agriculture, or CSAs, or I thought we had a third one, for farm markets. We did not get to the level of detail of saying if a CSA had to go further out, because our crude cut on it was that any CSA is frankly going to be more local than the 500, 5,000 miles that much of our food is coming from. So we didn't get into the finer level. You know, we did talk about, I can't remember if it's in here, frankly. I could look, but I can't. We talked about whether there should be a 50-mile radius or something for farm markets. I honestly don't remember without looking, but I'm glad to talk with you about it further offline. But we didn't, for the most part, get into that distinction compared with the worldwide food system right now. We thought anything we could do to help more local would be an improvement upon the current system.
Well, I think that's about it for our time. I'd like to thank Susan and Heather one last time for their expertise and knowledge.
Thank you.